Comedy thing, nobody laughed. It scared them more than anything. Do you remember when Kamala made his debut on TV?
Saw
us up on the monitor and it
saw us off on the monitor and the fat lady in the crowd screaming. Yeah. Buddy Wayne walked around like a beekeeper. And it was treated, you know, Lance and Dave both stand up and back up and tell, get him away. Take him over there.
Right.
You know.
Both of them scared of him. It was
yeah.
Great. So he debuted with Lawler, did a disqualification. The next week he defeated Lawler for the title. In the next few weeks, of course, Lawler is the big money. That's where they're going. Kamala defeated King Cobra, Stan Lane, Steve Kern, Dutch Mantel, Bill Dundee. Finally got to Lawler, and they did another disqualification. There was a match held, or a card booked on August the 2nd. It sold out. It was Jimmy Valiant against Kamala. How bad would that match would have been? But Valiant apparently, this is a story, and you investigate this kind of stuff. So Valiant obviously called in and said that he passed. In the Charlotte airport, he didn't come. So they went with Dundee and Lawler against Kamala and Dundee in the main event. But didn't hurt too much because the next week they came right back. Lawler won the title by defeating Kamala on August the 9th. And I thought that was all interesting. But what do you know? Because you're a Carolina guy. Was it a work by Valiant? Did he really pass out? What the hell happened?
I don't, you know, I've never heard a handsome no-show in a town, ever. So, I don't know. I mean, that's possible, or maybe he just didn't want to fly to Memphis that week. Because at that point in time, he was the man in Charlotte. He was over, because Flair's gone with the world title. And Boogie Woogie Man is the top baby face in the territory. And he may have just said, you know what? I can make whatever spot show they got here, or I can go to Monday would be Greenville or one of them towns, Greenville or Spartanburg. I can't remember which one was Monday. One was Monday, Saturday. Go there or go down to Columbia or wherever. Be home that night, sleep in his own bed. Here's a great Kamala Handsome Jimmy story. Kamala goes to Charlotte shortly after here. He may have went to Watts first, then to Charlotte, or maybe Charlotte to Watts, I can't remember. They're giving him the big push, and he goes and he gives his notice and says, I'm leaving to go to New York. This is when Vince is starting to take the guys for the national expansion. So everybody gets mad at Kamala and says nasty stuff to him. Why are you going for him? Why, you know, this and that. So, but Kamala did business right. He gave a notice. He said, I'll stay to this date and then I'm leaving. So
that's been going on since the beginning of time.
Right. So
but there was, back then, there was no opposition. That's the difference.
That right. So now he's getting heat from the office. He's getting heat from this. So they come and say, we're just going to beat you on the way out everywhere. You're going to get beat right in the middle every night. And he said, that's fine. Only person I'm doing it for is Handsome Jimmy. Because he's the only one to come over and said, hey, good luck. Hope you do well when you go up there. Everybody else was an asshole to me. So Handsome's going to beat me or nobody beats me. And there ain't nobody here that can beat me. So, Handsome has to go to every town with Kamala. They're having to fly Handsome around on a four-seat plane to make sure he's in every town to beat Kamala, plus take his bookings against Ivan Koloff or whoever in the other town. And that's what they did for 2 weeks. He would go on with Kamala second or third, come out, get in the plane, fly to the other little town he was booked in, or the major town that he was booked in from the spot show, or driving or whoever, and that's how they finished Kamala up and sent him on his way.
No doubt that Kamala. This business has always been about dream matches. In Memphis, it was always Waller and Flair. Flair was hot off the TBS show, and he was hot because he was the NWA World Champion. And it was a natural thing. And he showed up on August the 14th, 1982, at Memphis TV, and you need to get your pen out. Because we'll discuss it for just a little bit later. Again, we're running a long time. However, the Jerry Lawler interview and the Ric Flair confrontation, let's go ahead, Bo, and take a listen to Lance Russell, Jerry Lawler, and Ric Flair.
Special occasion today. We had the world's heavyweight champion in here, Ric Flair, and now we've got the Southern heavyweight champ, Jerry the King Lawler, who's got that belt around that week.
Yes, Lance, and it feels very, very good to hear you call me that again. You know, I told you it was a big, the biggest match of my career last week, and I was fortunate enough to come out the new Southern Heavyweight Champion. Now, I want to just come out here for a second for two reasons. First of all, to clear up all of this, I just thought I was going to have to send you a shovel out here because it was getting pretty deep a few seconds ago. Hard out here saying that he won the belt for me, and now I see he's even got my cup. Carl out here, and he's probably got his head a little going in the wrong direction, but it'll only take me a few minutes to straighten that young man out. And as far as Hart thinking that he ever won anything in his life, he's sadly mistaken, Lance. I beat the man with very, very little help from Jimmy Hart, I might add. He was there as a diversion, but I want to make this clear. You know, I had people telling me all along that, King, are you going in the first family? Are you teaming back up with Hart? Well, let me assure you that nothing was ever further from my mind because, you see, I used Hart. I made a fool out of Hart. I used him. I won my Southern Heavyweight title back. I'm the champion, and Hart's still running around the same little clown that he ever was. If he ever thought for one minute that I would take him back, the only way I told him that I would take him back as my manager was if he carried all my suitcases, did all my arrangements, and was just a general flunky, exactly like he was before when I first had him. That would be the only way. He expected me, Lance, to join the first family and be some first lieutenant or something like that. So I straightened him out real quick on that. Now, Hart, if you've got any other ideas about anything you ever want to do, business he wants to conduct with me, this is as close as you're going to get to me from now on, Hart. I want you to understand that, buddy. Just get within range, and I'm going to put this right upside your head. But enough about Hart, Lance. I want to say, you're right, this is an exciting day. You know, I got here early. I was supposed to wrestle. I see, you know, they don't have my name on the list.
No, it's not.
They had me down against Pat Hutchison. Now, you and I know you could beat Pat Hutchison, couldn't you, Lance?
Hey,
so I got dressed, Lance. And Eddie Marlin says, you're wrestling Pat Hutchison. I said, scratch me off the list. It is no use me even wasting my time. But I would like, before I leave today, I would like to have the opportunity to shake hands with Ric Flair, the World Heavyweight Champion.
If you haven't met Ric before?
Oh, I just said I would like to shake hands with Ric.
Oh, there.
He's supposed to wrestle now. If you could go ahead and ring the bell. Maybe
yeah.
I could just stay out here. And
okay, let me get around here. We'll tap the bell and we'll get the champion out of here. Because he is, as a matter of fact, coming up in the next bout. He's going against young Ric McCord and who we are first look at.
He's
here.
Obviously great, isn't he? I mean, you know, he sounded like he's full of confidence.
He is full of confidence.
He is the...
Come on.
get you to come over here in just a moment.
Mind if I just want to talk to you for just a second, wish you well on your match, shake hands, this kind of thing. You don't mind?
Rick,
Plenty of time for that.
Okay, and I think, obviously, these two gentlemen know each other. The Southern Heavyweight Champion, Jerry Lawler, and Ric Flair of the World.
Welcome you to this area. Come on. You know me as well as you know. Well, you don't know Lance, but you know we've wrestled a lot of cards in Florida just a couple of weeks ago. Jerry Lawler, you know. I mean, you know, I understand. I understand completely. Look, he's got that little devilish smile there. I know Rick very well.
I agreed to come to Memphis, Tennessee because world champion should give everyone an opportunity to see big time professional wrestling at its best. But Jerry Lawler, I believe they call him the king over here in Memphis, is not going to take up any time of the world champions. You see, there's a lot of women in this audience over there that are dying for me to slide out of the $7,000 rope. But Mr. Lawler, when I get through with the what's his name?
Rick McCord.
When I get through with Mr. McCord, I'll be back.
Well, let me say this now. It's all, you know, it's plain to see that you are here for one reason, and that is to impress all of these pretty women that you see sitting in the audience, and there are some pretty ones. You know, I heard you say that you had heard a lot about this area, about, you know, that maybe it's all rednecks and that kind of thing down here, but I think you can see from the people here that you were misinformed. And you want to, being the world champion that you are, the great, undoubtedly, as you said earlier, the greatest wrestler in the world today. Is that right? Well, okay. What you need to do here...
I couldn't have said that better myself.
Okay, fine. Oh, hey, you won't get any arguments from me. You know, what you want to do is look as good as possible. This is the first time that you've been on this TV in this area.
Right.
You want to impress these people. You want to look as good as possible today in front of this thousands of people that are watching. Now, I'm going to tell you something about Rick McCord. Now, I like Rick McCord, and this is no offense to Rick at all, but Rick is a young wrestler. He's fairly inexperienced, and I think it's safe to say that Rick has never won a match here on this television. Am I correct?
I don't remember if he did.
I'm not saying that as a knock to Rick. I'm saying it because the man is inexperienced. Now, we're a man of your caliber. To go in the ring there, you being the world heavyweight champion, were you to go in there and beat Ric Flair, and beat Rick McCord, you really aren't going to impress anybody. I mean, when you step in the ring there, you wouldn't be able to walk in that audience and get one person to say that man has a chance again.
You know, you and I just aren't communicating on the same level. You see, these people are here. I could go in there and wrestle a broom. They're here to see Ric Flair. Now, I'm telling you, I gave Memphis a little credit. Memphis has shown me a little bit more than I thought ever possible in the city of Memphis, Tennessee. But you don't seem to understand. These people over here have come to see me against anybody. It could be you. It could be, who's the little guy with the dark hair? What's his name? What do they call him? Bill Dundee. It could be anybody. Ric Flair, the greatest. Ric Flair, the legend. Ric Flair, your world champion.
It always people out here, world champion.
So there's no difference. You want me to wrestle somebody else? Give me somebody else. The competition is all secondary next to Ric Flair.
Rick, excuse me, just one more second. You just said the magic words there. If you are the world heavyweight champion, that is, there's no doubt in anybody's mind. You wear the gold, you're the greatest wrestler in the world today. So like you said, it shouldn't matter who you wrestle. Nobody's in your caliber, right? Well, why don't we let Rick go on back to the dressing room, and I had a match scheduled very similar to this man right here. If you don't mind, why don't you and I go in the ring? Now listen, like I said, no way. So when you beat me, you're going to impress these people. They will be impressed when you beat Jerry Lawler right in that ring.
You want to wrestle the world champion?
Don't you think anybody wants to wrestle the world champion? Hey, it's an honor for me, Rick. I would love to wrestle. It would be...
What time would it be? How many is
matches.
10 minutes, one ball, 10 minutes time.
You want 10 minutes of my time?
I would love it. Is that all right with you?
Non-title. Get in the ring, brother.
Wait a minute.
Rick Flair has said he will go on a non-title, one fall, 10-minute time limit bout.
Let me ask you one more thing. I realize I'm taking a lot of your time here, and it's very valuable, precious time. But since I or Rick McCord up there, nobody in this area is in the same caliber of wrestler as you, and that's true because you are the one and only world champion. Since we've only got 10 minutes, why don't we really make this interesting? Why don't we make everybody out there at home excited, all of these people really excited, make this the most interesting, exciting show that there's ever been on wrestling, and put the world title up for just the 10 minutes. No big deal. You probably beat me in 30 seconds.
You would be,
you're the world champion.
You wouldn't be putting all that country jive on me now, would you?
No. Do you know, Glance, would I jive the world heavyweight champion?
The world champion never puts his title on TV. Number one, I don't make $500,000 a year. I don't fly around in a big jet defending that title on local TV programs, you understand? But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Because you're a big deal around here. Because I even saw you on TV the other night. Boy, you were a real big deal the other night. Tell you what I'm going to do for you. What I'm going to do for you. And I'm going to do for Memphis. Because I think it's long overdue. You get in that ring, the belt will be on the line.
You heard it right there. Rick Flair said he would put the title on the line.
For 10 minutes, the World Heavyweight Championship is at stake in this ring, right?
That's what the man said. I didn't know you could have a 10-minute championship match. But Rick Flair has... So Rick McCord steps out. Okay, Dave, how about the official entrance? Whoa, how about this?
When did you first see this?
I saw it on the TV. It was TV was airing here then. So I would have saw it a week delay. We might have been 2 weeks on the bicycle tape up here because they weren't running here. So I think we were 2 weeks behind on the bicycle. But it was strange seeing Flair in the Memphis studio. And still to this day, when I see it, it's strange to see Flair in the Memphis studio. Well, I don't know why. You just don't associate Flair with Memphis wrestling. To me, the great world title matches of Memphis, of course, Lawler Briscoe, Lawler Funk, Lawler Race, Lawler Bockwinkle. Those were the great world title, and Lawler Curt Hennig. It's just, Flair did not fit in Memphis. The interview here is great. Here's the thing, too, with Flair. This is a different Ric Flair at this point in time. Because he's not having the same match every night.
Right.
He did not get into that routine until 85 when he was fed Nikita Koloff, who was green, strong, and could hurt you. And then he came right off of Nikita to work with Sting and Luger. So he had a safe match, and he just got in that routine. So there's a different feel of Ric Flair at this time. This is, at this point in time, this is where you see Flair, why he was chosen to be a world champion, why he got over so big in the Carolinas. He's so calm, he's so cool in the interview to set up the match. Then after the match, he's Ric Flair yelling and screaming and putting bounties on people, going to kill people, you know, going to do this and that. And it's just, they did the TV, and nothing ever came of it.
No doubt about it. And obviously they did a couple of years when Crockett came in 85 and they did the co-promotion type of thing. Lawler has clicked with every opponent, especially
think it, Flair was a world champion, and he was successful at that, and so he really thought he was a world champion. I'm not knocking him. That made him great. It really did. However, he went in, and I think he really, as a shoe, said, Lawler can't wrestle. Lawler, Memphis is in rickety big town. I don't think he gave Lawler a chance. I don't think he gave Memphis, Tennessee a chance.
Right.
I don't think he wanted to be at TV. I don't think in 1985 he wanted to rumble on. It's just one of the things that wasn't meant to be.
Yeah, I believe he came in, I'm going to be in control, I'm the world champion, they're going to do what I tell them. If I'm Ric Flair, and I'm not, just saying, if I was, and I got to that TV that morning, I would say, Lawler, this is your animal. This is your wheelhouse. You know how these people think. You know what they want. You know what to do. So just tell me, and we will do it.
He did the complete opposite.
Did the complete opposite.
Again, I'm not a big Ric Flair fan, and I know a lot of people are. I don't hate him or anything, but Nick Bockwinkel's my favorite world champion. I love...
Mine was Harley Race. I was always a race guy.
Harley is my second, but you can't go against the fact that Flair, you go to ball games now and they do the woos.
Thank you. Not good. got two of the greatest men that I've ever seen. They're the ones that's going to wear the tuxedos. They're going to wear the top pants. And yeah, they'll be doing the Fargo strut too, pal. And I'll be proud of them. I'll be proud to say, look at that. Look in the wrestling ring. Look. I look back 25 years ago. I see me and Donnie.
And those top hats, and then they started putting those the music to them and doing the music videos, and MTV's hitting its stride. Now all of a sudden on a wrestling show you got these two young guys out here with all these cool songs and all this stuff. It grabbed the attention of a whole new generation of wrestling fans, and that creation, the story I would always been told was the whole idea was after just a few weeks they were going to turn him heel and have Cornette manage him.
That's what I heard too.
But they
got over.
Right. That shows you they didn't have any thought of longevity in it. They didn't have any idea that what they were getting ready to do, what it was going to create. Now, if you go back and watch the music videos, do they hold up with time? Absolutely not.
But they got over with those.
They got over. And you know, you hear Cornette talk about how many pitchers, little 3x5, number 4x6, pitchers and 8x10s they were selling a week in the towns. You know, you see the videos of them trying to get to the ring with the girls groping at them and grabbing them. And here's the thing, too. They weren't just your white meat baby face tag team of, okay, you're going to get the heat on us, we're going to bleed, we're going to sell, and then one of us get a hot tag, and then we'll go home. These were two guys that would fight. I mean, look at their matches with the Moondogs, for God's sakes. So they're hitting each other with breaking the steps and using the boards off the steps and the trash cans and, you know, just everything they could pick up at ringside. Same thing with the sheep herders. So it was, they were cool, they were young, they were tough, they were the total package that was thrown together that nobody saw what was going to happen.
And it was complete magic, absolutely magic.
Oh, yes.
Just that fight of the year 1982 was magic, and we are going to wrap up 1982, and you
86 people, and as you start reading the card, I need some HT2O. I need some water, bro. So you start this card and tell everybody, and I want you, again, you mentioned it a little later, and let me say, sweet brown sugar. And Bobby Eaton, I'll go ahead, I'm so excited, I'll have to do this. Dutch Mantell and Rick Morton, just think about that. Hell of a day. Think about the fact, Bo, this is the opening match on the card. The opening match against Sweet Brown Sugar, Coco Ware, and beautiful Bobby Eaton. I'll let you read the rest of this card, but I am going to say this, that Coco and Bobby did a thing. They, where the referees with the babyface partner, and they had the other babyface, in this case it would have been Rick Morton, and they do the continual double team elbow drop, and the people would explode.
Yeah.
It was the damnedest thing. I've seen other people do it, and I've had other people do it. It wasn't the same. The timing on that was absolutely remarkable.
Yes, it was. So, second match, Superstar Billy Dundee and Terry Taylor beat Adrian Street and Apocalypse. Apocalypse was California hippie Mike Boyette, who is one of the most interesting characters ever in the pro wrestling profession. King Cobra over Carl Fergie. The Angel over Larry Hare. I don't remember Larry Hare. Jesse Barr beat Big Red Reese of Atlanta, Georgia. Bobby Eaton won a blindfold battle royal. Southern Tag Team Champions, the Sheepherders, beat the Fabulous Ones by disqualification. I can imagine there was blood and guts in that.
Absolutely.
Then Sabu, not the ECW Sabu, but this was, who was this Sabu, Randy?
Coco Samoa.
Coco Samoa, that's right. Over Jacques Rougeau. Don't push me, too much a bigger boy. I'll get over you for the Mid-America title. And then Jerry Lawler pinned AWA World Champion Nick Bockwinkle, and then the title was later given back to Bockwinkle on a reverse decision. But people left there thinking that Lawler was the world champion.
Absolutely, and the 10,000 people, they ended the year. And I wanted to give just a couple of facts about some of the people that were talked about, obviously, and you know, because it's in your neck of the woods, Frank Morrell was a mighty Yankee. He was a free angel. He was the Colossus of Death. He was Lucifer, and of course, he was the Spoiler. Just real quick thoughts. And let me say this. He was my tag team partner, me and him against Jim Cornette and Mark Curtis.
Yeah, in the Louisville Gardens.
Absolutely, in the Louisville Gardens. I had to throw that in. I don't think he'll put that on his resume, but Frank was from Kingsport.
Yeah.
Back in the woods, your thoughts on Frank Morrell?
I just had a discussion the other day. Here's one you don't have listed. His first wrestling nickname was Bulldog Frank Morrell. Name that Ron Wright gave him because he thought Frank looked like a bulldog.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because of his cheeks and jaws.
That's funny.
Frank
was a hell of a talent.
He was. And the thing about Frank, I have pictures of him refereeing when he's a teenager, breaking into business. The only difference of seeing Frank in those pictures and seeing Frank 20 whatever years later as the Spoiler or the Angel or whoever, Frank had hair on top of his head. He always looked much older than he was.
Right.
I mean,
absolutely.
Always. I've got a picture of him and Ron Wright from like 71. Or 72 from Charlotte when they were over there working for Crockett. And if you was to say who's the oldest guy here, you would think Frank was 8-10 years older than Ron Wright, which it was the reverse. But Frank was a great talent. He got over everywhere he went. He had that unique look. The only problem, anytime they put Frank under a mask, people knew who he was, you know, because he, no neck, big shoulders, big chest, you know, you knew it was Frank Morrell if he was the Assassin, the Spoiler, Colossus of Death, whatever he was. Hey, Frank, we know it's you. Take the mask off.
Yeah. Right. No doubt about it. Also, Frank Morrell is one of my favorite travel partners ever. I love Frank Morrell. Another name, and me and you together have never talked about this. What did you think, if anything, you might say you don't have a clue, but you try to keep up with everything. Big Red Reese was a 410-pound gentleman from Atlanta, Georgia. He ended up dying at age 52 in 2002. He was a preacher after wrestling.
He was actually preaching while he was wrestling. And he was the son of a pastor in Atlanta. He grew up a huge wrestling fan, going to the matches at the City Auditorium in Atlanta every Friday night as a kid. He got over in Detroit. He got over in Atlanta. He had a great interview. He had a big splash. His finishing called it the Holy Ghost Splash. He just had that charisma. He had that way of talking. And, you know, I don't think he ever got over in Tennessee like he did in other parts of the country. He's one of the few people in the wrestling business I have never heard anyone say a bad word. Never have I ever heard anybody say anything bad about him.
Except they might have said he wasn't a very good wrestler.
Right. But, I mean, But he knew that, and he knew his limitations, and he was able to get over with what he had.
Also, I think we need to certainly give credit to Nick Bockwinkle. Nick Bockwinkle was the son of the wrestler Warren Bockwinkle, in 72. He first won the AWA World Title, defeating Vern Gagne on November the 8th, 1975. And listen to this. A lot of times, well, heck, the WWE and the 24/7 title, sometimes you don't have somebody hold the title 7 minutes, sometimes 7 seconds. However, his first title reign was 1,716 days, and then he lost the title in Vern Gagne's retirement match on November the 8th, 1970. Five, and as soon as Vern retired, Stanley Blackburn gave the belt back, of course, since in the story on television, on the air. Gave the title back to Bockwinkle, he ended up training to Hansen and different things, but he held the title in 1987. He lost the title the final time, and I don't have a date, to Curt Hennig at Superclash. He was a road agent in the WWF. He worked for WCW because he had ties to Eric Bischoff, because Eric started in the AWA territory. He's a four-time AWA World Champion, a three-time AWA World Tag Team Champion. He was a member of the 1996 Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame.
And he said, how many days do I have to work? And they said, 350. And he said, forget it. I work 15 days a month for Vern, and I make just as much money. So, because he could go work in Memphis or Houston or wherever else on his off days.
Did you ever meet Nick Bockwinkle?
Yes. Two stories real fast about meeting Nick Bockwinkle. I saw one of Nick Bockwinkle's last professional wrestling matches live in Johnson City, Tennessee, in June of 1987, right after he had lost the title to Curt Hennig. They sent him into Continental he did Birmingham, Knoxville, Chattanooga, Johnson City, Montgomery. He did a whole week, and wrestle a different opponent each night in each city. And the deal was, if that person beat Nick, they got the shot at AWA World Champion Curt Hennig when he came to the territory. Now, we didn't know what was going on in other cities other than, you know, like Knoxville, the ones that overlap. So I knew, I saw him in Johnson City against Jimmy Golden, one of the greatest live matches that I ever saw. And it was unreal watching Nick Bockwinkle live. And as he's going back to the dressing room in Johnson City, I'm standing there by the aisle. And I stick my program out in front of him. And he stops and signs it. I still have it to this day.
I'm going to steal that the next time I come to your house.
So, fast forward almost 30 years. Misty and I are given a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Cauliflower Auto Club in Las Vegas. Bockwinkel, this was Nick's last year as being the president of the CAC. We see Nick come into the room. This is the day before we get our award or something. We're in the convention hall selling books and DVDs and stuff. And Bockwinkel comes in with his wife. So I got up and I went around the table. And I said, "Hello, Mr. Bockwinkel." And I stuck my hand out to introduce myself. And he said, "I know exactly who you are." And called me by my name. Because he knew we were getting the award and he had seen the press that they put in the program for us. And I got to tell him the story of him stopping and signing my program after going 45 minutes with Jimmy Golden. And he said, "I was just happy somebody liked it." He said, "I was happy, you know, somebody wasn't throwing something on me." And he said, I never did that. So, I don't know if I'm the only person that he ever stopped and signed a program for as he's leaving after, I mean, he's covered in sweat, just went 45 minutes, but he stopped and signed my program. Class act all the way. What a wonderful guy. You know, I knew lots of people over the years that knew him and got to spend a lot more time with him than I did, but he was a machine inside the ring, and him and Lawler had a chemistry that Lawler did not have with anybody else. And he could get the most out of nothing. The one match, and it may have been this one, I've seen so many matches, but there's one match where he's got the hammerlock on Lawler, and Lawler keeps trying to get out of it, but he can't reverse it because when he'd step through, Bockwinkel would step around and hold the hold. And Bockwinkel starts yelling at Lance Russell at ringside. "This is your boy. This is the best you have. This is the great king of wrestling. He can't even get out of a hammerlock." And they're just sitting there in the hole. And he's having his match with Lance Russell verbally. And the people are getting so mad. So when Lawler finally dropped hold, holds him and he takes the face bump and sells his mouth and nose on the mat, the roof of the building comes off. Because he had a psychology that most people did not have. And he had a flow and a way of talking and a way of working that most people did not have.
And absolutely tremendous. And that's why he's my favorite world champion. And of course, Harley is right in there, but I would have to say Nick Bockwinkel without a shadow of
a doubt. Nick probably would be mine if I didn't see Race first. You know,
yeah, good point.
Race was the world champion when I started going to the wrestling matches, and I saw Race defend the world title on my 8th birthday against Handsome Jimmy, and I was sitting in the front row. You know, so I think Race sentimental value, and I think too I've met Race many more times over the years in Harley Race, another one who has always been so nice and so kind to me.
You know, 1980 was a real good year, man, for Lawler being gone. It was a transition year, and to form the first family and got Hart hot as heck. And then 81 and 82 were both great years, and we've been talking for hours, so much things. You know, originally, Bo, I didn't tell you this, but originally I advertised last week when I did this, when I was doing the 70s. I did every year in the 70s. I did 70 all the way through 79. So I plugged the fact that we would do all the 80s today. But heck, I was doing the research and write down stuff, and I probably should have just did two steers instead of three. There's so much. The debut of Kamala, Waller Return, the Kaufman, the Empty Coliseum, the fabulous ones. It was just so much. Next week, and if Sean flies the coop again, we'll have Bo back. But next week, we will talk about 83, 84, 95. 83 was the biggest year at the gate ever. Now, as far as money, you know, there was attendance years that were better, but it's, you know, as much as I do, it's all about the dollars and cents. And the biggest year at the gate was... was that year in 1983. Now, interesting year. Waller had some plans. He was a little unhappy. A few other people were very unhappy with what was going on in the territory with Jerry Jarrett, with Bill Dundee, and with just everything going on. Waller had made some plans to take over and then ended up agreeing not to do it, and I think that was smart. He became the booker and booked for over the year, and a great year with the Dundee Lawler Loser League Sound Match. The Randy, just a second. Yeah. Randy Savage debut, Road Warriors made appearances. In 85, where Nesto came in to book Lawler, the return, just all kinds of things went on. Go ahead, Bob.
And Willie was banished to Chattanooga.
Chattanooga, June. Of 1983, and then, yeah, of course, to Louisiana in 84, and because Ole Lee didn't get Tennessee wrestling, that didn't work out, but at least Bill White, I'm surprised that didn't hurt Dundee's reputation, but it didn't hurt him with Bill Watts, and Bill Watts let him do his thing, and Bill Watts had the best 2 years that he ever had when Bill Dundee was booking. This has been a lot of fun, and I want to remind everybody, tell them what they can find at kingofkingsport.com, and also the other option to look at Southern State Wrestling. Do all your plugs.
All right. Follow me on Twitter at King of Kingsport. Follow me on Facebook at Pro Wrestler Bo James, B-A-U. Everybody misspells my name wrong the first time. KingofKingsport.com, classic Knoxville Continental Southeastern DVDs. Check them out there, all kinds of good stuff. Plus my books, Do You Want to Be a Wrestler Kid? That's my first book, my autobiography about growing up around wrestling, starting as a promoter at 14 years old. Yes, 14 years old, promoting towns for Ronnie West. Starting in the ring at 15 years old. Becoming a boss at 16 years old. Fighting demons until I found true love. It's all there in the book. You're going to love it. Tributes to a lot of my dead friends that a lot of people have told me that really touched them. Then there's my second book, It Takes All Kinds, The People, Places, and Events That Make Up Pro Wrestling. That is 25 years of short stories of stuff that has happened on the road. And there's a lot of great stuff in there that'll make you laugh, make you think, make you cry, possibly. And then don't miss this, the history of pro wrestling in the city of Kingsport, Tennessee, 1960 through 1969. Learn about East Tennessee wrestling history with a 100-year history lesson. Then the decade that made Ron Wright and Whitey Caldwell legendary names that nobody will ever break their attendance records. Nobody will ever be remembered as long as they have. We're 47 years past since Whitey Caldwell was tragically killed in a car wreck. Randy, 47 years later, fans still put flowers on his grave. And I know that for a fact because he's buried in the same cemetery that my grandfather is in, and I go by there and I see him. So that tells you how over that man was here. So you can find all that stuff there. If you would like to help, because here's what I'm working on now, 1950s, 1970s. Ron Fuller and I have been working. working on the 70s book, making sure everything's right on his side. I've interviewed Ronnie Garvin. I interviewed Ron Wright, Don Wright, Les Thatcher, Zach Murray, Mac McMurray, so many people that were involved in Southeastern Wrestling and on both sides of the split in the territorial war. We have the Bluefield. We have Knoxville. We have Harlan and Hazard and all the Kentucky towns. The digital newspapers are not digitalized. So I have to now physically go to the library, sit there, look up on microfilm the ads, and then I have to get them to make copies off for that. If you would like to make a donation to have your name in the book as a special thanks when it comes out, or other offers I make, check out King of King Sports. You can make a donation there to help us get the research and get these books out. Because if Randy and myself and a lot of other people like us, our generation, once we're gone, the history of this business before 1990 will be forever forgotten. Or
reliving the biggest moments in the history of wrestling's greatest territory.
You want to see the king? You think anybody would pay to come down to see a sawed-off runt, bug-eyed Bill Dundee?
No,
they come to see me, baby.
I feel good. I feel like doing it better. I feel like doing it
better. When I get a chance, and I don't care where it is, Lola, believe me, I am going to take you out.
You want to be nuts? Well, I can be a little nuts too, Daddy. So it ain't playing no wrestling games, Jack. You're not throwing nothing in my face. And you ain't sneaking up behind
and
doing nothing with a superstar.
And now, here are your hosts, the legend, Jerry Jerry.
Hundreds of wrestlers a month wanted to come to Memphis. People that had never been in the ring to people that had headlined one of the other territories.
Joined by the greatest Korean force in the history of professional wrestling and someone who is just a fantastic person when you get to know him in real life, Mr. Jerry Jarrett, how are you today, sir?
Well, I'm fine, Sean, and I have a question for you right out of the box.
Okay.
Out of the box. When you become rich, you're already very famous and gaining ground daily. Ladies and gentlemen, in case you don't know it, Sean Reedy will be hosting Jerry the King Lawler with his million followers podcast. Congratulations, Sean.
Well, you know, obviously, thank you so much for that. And all of these opportunities started when you decided to do a podcast with someone who had no business asking you to do a podcast in retrospect. Now, at the time, I thought it made good sense. Now that I look back, it was crazy. But somehow you went with it.
Sean, you... I never doubted that it wouldn't, you wouldn't do a terrific job. And I don't doubt that you won't do a terrific job with Jerry Lawler. And I want the fans to know, Sean Reedy has a unique perspective on the wrestling business that very few have. He is a young man, and yet he knows so much of the history of the territory days, with Memphis in particular. A broad depth of understanding of the wrestling business. And I am fortunate that I can tap into that knowledge, and that you are to be commended for your vast knowledge of the wrestling business.
Well, I mean, geez, thank you so much. It's so much to hear. Should we just wrap it up for this week at that point? I think that might be a good... No, well, thank you so much. You know how much that means to you, and I'll thank you off the air more appropriately. But today our topic, we thought in theme with what's going on, was going into the career of Jerry the King Lawler from its very beginning. And then just kind of going through, we'll see if we get through this in one episode or two episodes, just his illustrious run in the Memphis territory and going into detail with the perspective of the man who kind of created the King and had so much to do with that success. So I know you were interested in kind of starting off with the story of how he broke into the business, which was very unique.
Yeah, Jerry was a gifted artist. Went to Memphis State University on a art scholarship. Went to work for Jackie Fargo at a radio station. And Jackie would hire Jerry to do sketches and billboards and kind of a graphic artist for the station. But Jerry had a passion for the wrestling business. So when he wasn't working with graphic arts, he was drawing the various wrestlers that he watched on. This kid is really gifted. Would you mind taking a few minutes and letting him bring his art and take it out and show it to Lance Russell? And I said, no, that'll be a great addition. So Jerry brought his artwork, may have come two or three times, but as he got a little bit older, his passion for the wrestling grew and he started training, wrestled for some little independents over in Arkansas, and approached Jackie again. Jackie came to me and said, he just wants to be on television, and I think he will do a good job. So I said, sure, send him down. We can always use more enhancement talent. So Jerry came to Memphis TV, and I don't remember who I put him in the ring with, but he just was sensational. The first match he got in, took terrific bumps, could sail, could throw good punches, and the only thing that he did bad was he had a nervous tick that he would smile inappropriately. He's supposed to be real mad at somebody and he's got silly grin on his face. He's supposed to be getting the heck beat out of him, and he's got this silly grin on his face. So I told him, I said, Jerry, if you want to make it in the business, you're going to have to learn to portray through your facial expressions what's going on in the match. When you're beating somebody up, it's all right to be a little happy, but when you're beat up, pounded, thrown over the top rope on the concrete floor, it should hurt.
Okay, Extreme Rules is in the book. I actually went down and saw it. My match, my reason for going, the Undertaker match with Roman against Shane and Drew McIntyre was the first match, and the Undertaker and Roman won. Finn Balor lost the IC title to Nakamura. Bobby Lashley was Strowmaned by Braun Strowman. That went all over the building. I should know. Let me see. The Revival defeated the Usos. It was... Oh yeah, it was... Aleister Black defeating Cesaro in Aleister's first pay-per-view match for WWE. Now since somebody went knocking on his trailer door. I didn't see the three-way tag match. I had to leave before that, while that was going on. But I do know that AJ Styles is the new United States champion, defeating Ricochet. And I understand that Lacey Evans has a tattoo of Seth Rollins on her ass. And Bayley did defeat Nikki Cross and Alexa Bliss. And there was no sign of Sasha